Welcome to episode number 89 for the National Land Realty Podcast, where we discuss all things land. Our goal here is to inform, educate, and entertain those of you who own land or are interested in the buying and selling of land throughout the United States. My name is Mac Christian, and I am the Chief Marketing Officer here at National Land Realty. I will be your host for this episode. Now, today we're here to ask a few questions, and we're also here to get a few answers. So some of those questions are, can a squatter legally take your land? How should you handle a neighbor's fence on your land? Are old unused easements still viable on your land? How should you give land to your kids? Now, today we're here with Tiffany Lashmit. She's the Associate Professor and Extension Specialist in Agricultural Law at Texas A&M University. In other words, she knows her stuff. She will help us answer those questions and more today. And we also have, I know that I said that I was the host of the episode. I'm going to say that I have a co-host in this episode because Wayne Dunson has been on this podcast several times, and he always brings valuable perspective. He's the managing broker for National Land Realty's West Texas office, and he brings some terrific questions here today as well and some terrific insight. Now, not knowing what we talk about today will cost you money and potentially result in lost land. This is an episode you want to listen to. Now, sit back and enjoy. Okay, so I am sitting here today with, we've got a repeat guest here. Wayne Dunson is my co-host for, I think, half of the podcast that I do out of Texas. And we have here today with another special guest, Tiffany Lashmit. Tiffany, give us a little bit of background on yourself. You've got a great background. You teach, you know, land law. You know, and you're located in Texas as well. Just walk us through your background a little bit, and then we can kind of jump into the conversation here because I think it's a good one.
Sure. Yeah. Thank you guys for having me. I'm excited to be here to chat today. Like you say, I'm based here in Texas. I'm the Extension Agricultural Law Specialist for Texas A&M AgriLife Extension. I'm based in Amarillo, but I cover the entire state. And yeah, I go around and teach rural landowners and ag producers about different ag law issues that could affect them. So, I mean, that's anything from, you know, water law, fence law, property taxes, landowner liability, eminent domain, kind of all any legal issue you could think of that could affect a rural landowner in Texas. I kind of work in that realm. And I do that in a number of different ways. I do a lot of presentations either on Zoom or in person. I've got a blog. It's called the Texas Agriculture Law Blog. And I've got a podcast called Ag Law in the Field, but really all just aimed at educating rural landowners here in Texas.
I feel like I should just pull you into every podcast that I do. I think that would be beneficial to everybody. And then Wayne, You've given your background before, but you know, I'm not going to bank on everybody listening to all of our podcasts. So give us a bit of your background, man.
Yeah. So my name is Wayne Dunson, and I'm the managing broker for the West Texas office. So I cover a pretty good expanse of West Texas. Really, I mean, if you look at the map, I'm the only one west of Fort Worth and all the way to El Paso. So it's a long stretch. Now, I don't sell in that whole area, but. Anyway, I definitely do get the good opportunity, though, to broker this office out here and land sales. So I specialize mostly in, you know, ranch, agricultural, recreational properties out here. Most of what I deal with usually is recreational buyers, people buying property for hunting. Some folks that run livestock usually for ag exemption purposes more than anything, hobby ranching. And if I get lucky enough, I get into some farm things. That's not always easy to pick up. So, but I dabble in solar and, you know, a little bit of wind. And I can add Podcaster of the Year now for National Land Realty as of 2023. So I got to put that out there, you know.
I think
so. Yeah, you buried the lead there. You buried the lead.
Right?
Yeah. So, we were just having a conversation right before we started because we do a little bit of prep on this podcast, you know, but I think we had a good idea. We talked last week, had topics kind of dialed in, but I think the best way to start off on this, and what we're talking today is easements and land rights and land law. Now, the big disclaimer on this is we're talking about Texas land law. That's not going to apply to Georgia land law, Alabama land law, Idaho land law. It applies to Texas, but there are similarities in land law throughout the country. It's going to give you a base idea no matter where you are, but make sure to check on it. And don't repeat the things that we say in another state like you know what you're talking about. You might get smoked by somebody who actually knows. But we want to be able to give you the information to where you can look into it and have a base idea as to what you're looking for. But Wayne, you were talking about a specific case, and again, keep it confidentiality aside, that you were working with some easements with a property. I wondered if you could disclose any of that in this conversation, because I feel like it's a really good lead off.
Sure. So, and this is something that's common. And I'm sure Tiffany has seen this a bunch and had this come up a lot with what she does. So the deal that I've got right now, which is going to happen a lot, I think, especially now when you see properties that have been in the family. So you see a lot of generational land use change. A lot of the older farming and ranching families, the younger generations have moved off site, and a lot of them don't have any desire to go back to that lifestyle. They moved into town, or maybe there's just not enough money in it. There's a host of reasons why that's changing. And so that property will get split up and then sold off or whatever. And when they divide that up, they don't always divide the property up in a way that makes sense or that's done, I guess you could say, I would say legally. But that it's not right, because they've probably divided it legally, that they probably had a probate attorney or somebody that's helped them divvy up the property. But in one case, they actually drew numbers out of a hat and said, you get this one, you get this one, you get this one. And there's the roads that the family traditionally used.
I gotta jump in because I'm watching Tiffany's head just droop off of the screen.
I'm taking notes. I want to comment on, but let's start with a good estate plan never involves drawing numbers out of a hat. Let's just start there. Okay, keep going.
Yeah, that's probably one of the funnier ones I've heard, but I'm living with it now on one. Anyway, but here's the thing that I think a lot of families don't understand is just because they had one road and it went through all the way to the back of the ranch, and that's how they checked water, and when they were checking their cattle and they put out cubes or whatever, that it didn't matter that there was four gates. That was all the same family. Well, when that got divided up and they split it in pastures, now that road needs to be an easement. Especially when they sell the property and the family is no longer the ones that are operating it, you've got to have legal access to each one of those. And so there's only like one or two of the parcels in this area that have access to county road. Everything else behind it is going to need easements. And so, and they don't usually know that. So we get into some contentious situations where we have properties that either we can't exactly get clear title because there's no legal deed of access to the property, or we've got to deal with family that maybe doesn't want to have an easement through them. So that can get pretty sticky sometimes.
So Tiffany?
Yeah, it's an issue I get calls on a weekly basis. It's happening all over Texas. And let's start just with a legal fact. And this is true in Texas. It's not true in every state, but in Texas, there's a real myth, and people will say all the time, well, my property can't be landlocked, right? Someone legally has to give me access. That's absolutely false in the state of Texas. I think it's true in other states, right? There are other states where there's a mechanism by which if you prove you're landlocked, you automatically get access. Not the case here. And so it's really important for people to understand you can have landlocked property, and that causes you a real problem, right? On a number of fronts. Number one, you can't get to it to use it, right? You also are going to have a really hard time selling it because you can't get title insurance on it. Nobody can get a loan to buy it without that title insurance. You can't borrow money against it. I mean, it really is a problem, and people need to understand, you know, just like Wayne is saying, when property gets divvied up, if there are not those recorded, written, legal easements, you're going to run into problems down the road. And as far as Texas law works, there's four or five different ways you could potentially prove access to landlocked property, but none of them are a guarantee, and they're all very fact specific. there are some situations where you just can't prove the facts you would need to prove, and that property may truly be landlocked. So I think the first thing is just making people aware that this is, that's how the law works, right? And this can be an issue. You know, the other thing, we're terrible in ag and rural America about doing everything on a handshake, right? So this probably started where we have an access easement where my grandpa could cross your grandpa's land and they were friends and they went to church together and they shook on the deal. Well, that's fine. But, you know, 30 years from then, we've got grandkids own it. And then the other piece maybe has been sold three times to somebody from California and they have no relationship. Why am I going to let you cross my private property, right? And that's where people are ending up in a lot of trouble all over the state. I mean, it's really an issue everywhere.
I think we're seeing that nationwide because it's kind of, you know, it's been well documented right now. We're going through one of the greatest transfers of land and wealth in the history of our country, right? You have a lot of landowners that early 1900s to mid 1900s purchases that have either stayed in the family, or you could even go back to, you know, some of these purchases go back to the 1800s that have stayed in the families. And now you have either a sell-off or a sales for development, or exactly to your point here, where there's multiple grandchildren, kids, grandkids, all involved in the mix now, where you had one landowner before and now you've got like 12, and right, nothing has been documented as things go on. So I guess a good question, Tiffany, if you are one of these landowners, because I think this presents a lot of value for any landowner out there where you have inherited land, what are the steps that you should take in order to get things on the up and up to make sure that, you know, if you have divided land or undivided interest in the land, and I think that's two good perspectives to look at, is the divided and undivided interest. How do people address these concerns in front of the possibility of a sale, or in, you know, in order to deflect from any kind of conflict?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think that at least on this piece of it, the same is true, whether it's an undivided interest or a divided interest in the property. The biggest thing is do it before you have a problem, right? Don't wait till you're ready to list the property. Don't wait until the neighbor is sending you a cease and desist letter. Let's deal with it now. That's the most important thing. From an easement perspective, anybody who owns land needs to know whether there are any easements on their property. I would start with just a real simple, like, you know, look at your title policy and see if you have a title policy, right? Look at that and see if there are any exceptions on that title that deal with easements. You can go to the deed records at the courthouse in the county where the land is located and go dig through and see, can you figure out, are there any easements on that property? So I think looking to see, are there any recorded legal easements is a really good place to start. Another thing you need to do, though, is go look at the property and see if anybody else is making any uses of that. Is someone driving across the property on a road, right? Even if it's not recorded, there are certain types of easements, in Texas, at least a prescriptive easement is one of these, that they may be able to claim if they've crossed that enough and met all these certain criteria, right? So you need to see if fences are where they're supposed to be. See if anybody is, you know, using your property when they're not allowed to. That brings up adverse possession issues. So kind of that type of an inspection, I think, is also really important. This is beyond the scope of what we're going to talk about today, but I just want to hit on this for anybody who's buying or inheriting land. Two places not to overlook going. One of them is your county appraisal district. Make sure that when you inherit land or you purchase land, go directly to the county appraisal district and get everything put in your name. And at least in Texas, a really important step to take is fill out the paperwork to keep that open space or agricultural use valuation on the property. It doesn't automatically stay when ownership changes. And I get calls on this every year about the time that tax bills go out. People will say, right, I inherited this farm. It's been farmland since 1950, and now they're taxing it at fair market value. It's because you didn't go into the paperwork. It doesn't automatically transfer. So county appraisal district, same thing at your local USDA office. That's the Farm Service Agency, the Natural Resource Conservation Service. Get everything in your name there as well. There may be programs you might qualify for. There may be programs your land is signed up for under someone else's name. That's just another place you want to check anytime you inherit property.
Those are really, really good points. And then you brought up the point of prescriptive easement. And for those listening that are not familiar with the term prescriptive easement, what you're hearing is the actual, you know, they call them squatters' rights, right? Where if someone squats your land and they have continuous use for an extended amount of time, they can legally take that land. If you're not using it and they are, and it is a legal thing. So that's something where, exactly to your point, Tiffany, going out and getting eyes on and checking out your land, that's something that holds a lot of value to you. You might accidentally not take, if you're not looking into it, someone might, you know, end up with a new piece of land that used to be yours.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, I remember learning about this in law school and thinking, well, this can't really come up all that often. It comes up all the time. not in like the classic example, right? Like the law school example was like, if there's a wooded piece of property and someone goes out and builds a cabin and claims it. I don't get those phone calls. But constantly I'm getting phone calls about somebody has used this road for however many years and you never objected, right? Then there's other factors. There's lots of things you have to prove here. But if they can prove those facts, they could actually get a legal easement because of that adverse use. As far as the ownership changing, yeah, adverse possession is a real concern. Again, not easy to prove. Lots of facts have to be shown. But if there's a situation where, you know, if the fence is maybe off the property line, there's not any sort of boundary agreement, the other party has taken some action like replaced that fence or substantially rebuilt that fence or something, they may be able to claim ownership of that land that belongs to you. So yeah, I really don't think you can overstate the importance of getting eyes on your property and taking action if you see something going on that's not supposed to be happening.
So you spoke to a couple of things that people can do to sort of, you know, take charge and get this stuff, you know, dialed in. I was wondering if you could drill down a little bit into that and give, you know, anybody listening the steps involved. So you mentioned going down to the USDA, going down to the State Department. When somebody goes into those places, what do they need to ask for and what do they need to say and get a hold of?
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, at the County Appraisal District, you can just go in and you just want to make sure that your name is the one on the property. If you have a property tax bill, that's the easiest way to do it because it'll have like your parcel number listed and they can match it right up. If you don't have that, you could take, it depends on how you got the property, right? If you purchased it, take a copy of your deed that you get at closing, right? You take that down there and they can get that all switched over. If you inherited the land, you may have to take either a copy of the will or you're going to need to have the executor come in and make that transfer and take a copy of that deed once that's transferred over. So just something to show, right, that you have this ownership interest in the property. At the FSA office or the NRCS office, kind of the same thing. One thing you want to ask while you're there is you want to get your hands on what is your farm number. Everything at FSA and NRCS is done based on farm number. And so if you can figure out what that is, that's very useful. On that note, again, this is not our topic at all today, but from an estate planning perspective, really good idea to, I got a whole list of items. I tell people to like write down, put in a folder so that somebody can come in when you're gone and take over. Include those farm numbers in there for them. So when they go to the FSA, they know what they're asking for. So those are just kind of some simple things. Like I say, at the courthouse, if you want to go look at the deed records, you just need to have the information about your property. A deed is probably the best thing to have. They can go pull those records for you with that deed.
And Wayne, you spoke to this again, kind of right before we started, you know, recording here, of encountering this issue of fences not being accurate according to property boundaries. This is a pretty common thing, right?
It's real common, actually, at least for the stuff that hasn't traded hands in a long time. And whether it was something that was divided up amongst family or it was part of a bigger ranch that sold off over time. And there may have been fences that were used for pasture line markers or whatever, or they just stuck it here because there was a tree there or because of a water feature or contours, whatever. But they may not have actually been on the section lines. And what I've run into out here in West Texas is technology has improved. So even though I can find the old concrete marker, when they actually use the modern technology, it could be 10 feet over there. And that's what, so, you know, now the fence is way over on this side and you've lost this whole mile of property that's 10 feet over. Who would have ever thought that, you know, just a difference in the way they used to lay out the section lines would cause that kind of difference. But especially too, if you have farms where it was always farmed, they used to say back in the day, fence row to fence row, and then CRP came in and they started planting all that into grass and grazing it. So then you need to fence it, and they may not have fenced. They just may have built it wherever it seemed handy. Well, we got a road right there, put the fence along it. But you just don't ever know what you're going to run into. So I try to verify fences every chance that I get by looking at legal descriptions and whatnot. And unfortunately, a lot of people don't want to pay for a survey. If they've owned that land and it's been in their family for three generations and you tell them it's going to cost $3,500 to $5,000 or whatever to survey something, it's rare that they'll do it. And sometimes I have to say, listen, we could actually be missing out on a lot of money at certain price ranges. If you have more land here than you thought? Now, contracts can address that, but I think it's best to try to, and if you can get them to survey it, it's awesome. And I wanted to ask Tiffany this, fence lines included, but also the best way to go about verifying, like say I have a property and we can't get the prescriptive easement deal done, but I need to have a recorded easement to this piece of land. And I've got one right now. So I actually genuinely want to know. My advice was to get a surveyor and actually stake out the road from this road to his gate so that we have an exact figure with a map going to the property with a legal description written to go with that so that we could file that with the county, with the county clerks, so it would be recorded. And that we could also clear title with it and all that. But that was my advice on that deal. I don't know if that's the best route, but that's what I told them to do. So I hope it's not too far off.
Yeah. So you said that you couldn't get a prescriptive easement. Is the other party willing to grant you an easement? I assume that's what you're staking out, is what they're willing to grant you or yes. Sell you or whatever. Yeah.
Yes.
I always tell people, and I've got a list. Let me back up. I've got a handbook. And one of our chapters deals with access to property. And it walks through five different ways you may be able to get legal access to property. I always tell people, no question, your best bet, your cheapest option is going to be to try to get an express easement from somebody, right? One of those neighboring landowners, have them grant you an easement. Even if you have to pay them, it's going to be cheaper to pay them almost always than it's going to be to pay a lawyer to try to fight to prove one of these implied easements. So if you got one of the neighbors to grant you an easement, I think you're spot on. Get that surveyed. Make sure we have the exact, you know, meets and bounds or whatever it is. Get that recorded in the deed record. That's always your best bet. Now, like I say, there are situations where you can go to court and try to prove one of these implied easements. Again, very fact specific, impossible to prove in some circumstances. And you do have to go to court to get that granted for you, so that you can record it in the record. You can't just declare that you have this easement because you think you could prove these things, right? So I think that's exactly right. One other thing I'll say, I really preach the same as you on getting a survey. And it's wild to me because, like you said, people don't want to spend $3,500 on a survey. And I really preach this before you build a fence, get a survey. And they're like, I am not spending $3,500. But they're willing to spend like $15,000 a mile to build the fence that might be in the wrong place. I'm not great at math, right? Like I went to law school, but that makes no sense to me. And we just had a case in the last couple of weeks out of the Texas Supreme Court where a landowner was ordered to go in and move the fence that was encroaching on the other guy's property. So we paid the money to build the fence. Now he's going to pay the money to move the fence. You know what's cheaper than that? A survey. So anyway, that's a soapbox I have, but I agree 100%.
So Texas Supreme Court ruled on this case.
Yes, correct.
Wow. Yeah. That must have been a big one.
Yeah. Yeah. And you think about all the money they spent getting this to the Texas Supreme Court. That's a whole nother discussion, right? But
incredible. Yeah. So, and so that kind of lends me to what we were discussing before we really hopped in here officially, is I have a place right now. We surveyed it, so we know exactly where the property boundaries are now. But there's a fence that actually cuts up into us. Part of it was part of an old, and it's really weird, but this property spans two counties. And for some reason, back in the day, they built a fence right down the county line. And then there's a couple of weird zigzags in there, and about 75 acres is on a neighbor. And they've definitely been using it. And I'll tell you how long they've been using it. And this is what scared me. The old topo maps, the old school topographic maps, have this fence on it that way. How long has that been like that? Like, I don't even know when that topo map was done, but I was going, man, we could have a real serious issue with this if someone says something about that little jag in the fence. But we've got a survey to prove where the property boundaries are. But I don't know. I was worried about that quite a bit.
Well, you should be worried about it because, I mean, that's a situation where you could end up with an adverse possession claim, right? A squatter's rights claim, like Max said. But, you know, because one of the things is they have to make, it's like open and notorious, obvious use of the property continually under a claim of right for at least 10 years. Well, yours has been significantly longer than 10 years, right? Now, and I always say this to people, I'm going to be real clear here. Just because a fence is off the boundary line for more than 10 years, that alone doesn't create adverse possession. You've got to meet all these other requirements, right? So like, even if the fence is off and you've been grazing your cattle there, that alone is not enough either. But if you've made some claim to that, like you tell people that it's yours, you've built your own fence, you've rebuilt or like substantially improved or repaired the fence, those are facts that could certainly lend themselves to adverse possession. And so I think that's where a perfect example of, right, pay attention to your property, look at what's going on out there. And they might want to look at taking some action to get this remedied because, if they let it keep continuing, they could sure end up with a claim where they could potentially lose those 75 acres.
Yeah, I was going to say, is it 10 years? And that's where the state to state laws are going to be different because Idaho, right. I think at one point was 5 years and now I think it's 20. Like you have to be on that land using it every day for 20 years to get a prescriptive easement. And in this case, you're saying, and this isn't Texas law again, so making sure that people understand if they're communicating this to friends, you know, around the dinner table, this is Texas law, not everybody else's law. That just having a fence that encroaches your neighbor's boundary does not mean you have an option for prescriptive easement. You have to be basically walking around that land and using it.
You've got to make uses. And the courts have been very clear that just having a fence or just grazing cattle, even if you go out there and hunt a few times a year, the court said that's not enough. There's got to be more than that. In Texas, they really distinguish between what they call a casual fence, which is a fence built off the line, versus a designed enclosure where you've taken some action to make clear that you're like enclosing that and making a claim to it. So again, if you were to like change the fence, Wayne, you probably do this all the time. Let's say it started out with like a regular 5-strand barbed wire fence and the other party went in and turned it into a high fence. Now we don't have a casual fence anymore. Now it's a designed enclosure and that clock's ticking on that adverse possession.
So a question popped into my head as Wayne was talking about his situation, and this is a good question for you, Tiffany. Maybe it's not a good question, but I'm going to ask it anyways. So if you are a landowner, you have your survey done and you notice that your neighbor is encroaching on you, and let's just throw in there another scenario where they have, maybe there's a road along the fence that they ride every day. This becomes an opportunity for prescriptive easement. If you were the landowner that spots an encroachment, is it one of those cases? It almost, in my head, it feels like one of those situations. If you bring it up to your neighbor, it might cue them to take a prescriptive easement on your property and take that land. If you're the landowner, is it in the realm of possibility, go in the cover of night kind of thing, relocate your neighbor's fence and be like, done?
Yeah, you don't want to do that.
Okay. Because I think a lot of landowners would be like, I'm going to go rip that guy's fence out, and put that fence where it needs to be.
Right. There are statutes in Texas that deal with removing fences, and that is not allowed. So, no self-help remedies here. But the point you make back, I think, is a really good one. And that is, there really is some like legal strategy you have to think about here as to how you want to approach this. Right. And that's where I really would tell people, if you think this is a problem, it probably is worth a consultation with an attorney. You may not end up hiring them. You may end up being able to work it out with your neighbor. But having a consultation just to kind of get a game plan probably is worth the money. You know, and that's where you've got to weigh some things, right? Facts really come into play here. So if I've got a neighbor that's using this road without permission, I need to do some investigating, right? Did they ever have permission? Is there anything recorded in the deed records? How long have they been using it? Do I also use it? Because in Texas, at least, exclusive use is a requirement to claim by adverse possession or a prescriptive easement. So there's lots of facts you have to consider. And if it's a situation where, you know, they may have the ability to claim it by adverse possession or a prescriptive easement, if we're talking about an easement, you need to decide, okay, what are we going to do about this, right? Do we think that they can prove it or not? Is the clock still ticking such that we better act in a hurry before they have enough time? You've got to do a lot of analysis like that. And again, there's lots of options there, right? If you decide it is something you want to deal with, one option is to just go buy an easement from the neighbor, right? Or have that neighbor buy an easement from you. We get it written, we get it recorded, we're done. Another thing, especially if it's a fence that's out of place, you can do what's called a boundary line agreement. The two parties can write something down that just basically says, we know this fence is off the boundary line, Wayne, to your point, because the tree was in the way, or there was a water feature, or the cliff was here, or whatever. And we agree that the fence we're going to build is not on the boundary line. We also agree this doesn't change, you know, ownership or possession of property at all.
Okay.
Crazy enough, here's another option. You could give them permission to use it. If you don't care that they're using the road or the land or whatever, if you grant them permission, that defeats adverse possession or a prescriptive easement. It can't be adverse possession if they have permission. So another option might be grant them permission. Again, if you don't care, grant them permission, record something in the deed records. And then as long as they are making a permissive use, they can't ever claim anything beyond that permissive use, because that destroys adverse possession or a prescriptive easement.
I love that you talked about it from that perspective, though, because I think the instantaneous reaction for a lot of landowners is like, I'm going to go knock on his door and let him know. Like, no, don't do that. Get a strategy first. Figure out what's going on and then speak up, because you might accidentally inflate the situation to where they realize I'm about to claim 100 acres. You know, like,
that's right. Yeah. Okay. And then again, that's where it's so fact specific. Like, that's where you really need to analyze kind of where you're at, what their potential claims are, what yours are, and doing that's worth the time and money for sure.
I've never heard a boundary line agreement like actually in the sense like formally. I'm looking at a place right now, and they've got about a 400-foot plateau right behind the ranch house. The actual property line is way up on this rock cliff up there, and they're just grazing the insides of these canyons. There's a fence up there. You can see it, but they don't go up there. You can't get anything up on top.
Right.
And then the Pecos River is another mile of border, and it's floodplain. So they've got the fence way off the river to keep the livestock from getting over on the neighbor. There's a whole bunch going on this place. And I was going, dang, how does this all work? And I never understood that there was something that you could do. I mean, I know guys, well, we talked about it. We don't want any more handshakes anymore. That's how a lot of those guys used to do it back then. But boundary line agreement, I love that.
And what's important, I've said this a couple of times, but I just want to flag this so everybody understands. It's really important, any of these agreements you get in writing, boundary line agreement, easement agreement, anything like that, you have to record it in the deed records. Don't skip that step, right? Just because you have a written agreement, that being in writing makes it enforceable against the party who signed it. But if you want it to be enforceable against future parties, right, the person who inherits or the person who buys or whatever, that's where it needs to be recorded in those deed records at the courthouse. So don't overlook the importance of making sure everything we're talking about actually gets reported.
So what's the how on that? How do you get it recorded in the deed record?
Yeah, you just go down to the courthouse. You have to pay a filing fee or a recording fee, and that's it. It's usually a per page cost. I promise I'm not here for the like lawyer union, but I would on a lot of these things, I'd use a lawyer to draft something up, right? Especially on an easement. You know, if you're going to draft up an easement, I know it seems simple enough to just say, well, I'll let my neighbor can cross the property. But I'll tell you what's biting a lot of people right now is a lot of people did real broad easements that didn't have any limitations in them. And that was fine for them when it was the one neighbor who lived behind them crossing. But now that neighbor has sold the property and subdivided into these ranchettes, right? And now there's 20 people behind them crossing that road. And they wouldn't have ever given permission for that, right? So it's worth using a lawyer to make sure these get drafted like you want them. They're limited like you need them to be. And then you just take them in, file that, pay that fee. They get put in the deed records. You're good to go.
And these points that you keep bringing up are pretty fantastic, because what you just brought up is you know, it's the legal art of language, right? Where you might think that you wrote something that's bulletproof, because I have gotten myself into this a few times, writing something up, and then we always double check with attorneys when we do stuff like that, because I don't want any part of the end result, but I'll get it to a place where I think it needs to be. And then you find out that there's a wherefore versus therefore kind of nuance to the language that you don't realize changed the whole structure of what's in there, or even the definition of a term in the beginning of the contract that you go through and you didn't have a parenthesis or something. If you don't understand that structure, you could really step on a landmine. And and sure, it sucks to pay $1,000 for somebody to read a paper and write a report for you. It's $1,000 to do something like that is a lot less than losing 100 acres of land in that value or something like that. Like that's the kind of stuff that we're taking care of.
Yeah. Or avoiding like a lawsuit. I mean, my old boss used to say he had never taken a case to trial for less than $100,000. And that was a simple case just to trial, not appeals or anything like that. That $1,000 looks cheap now, right? In comparison, if we end up in a lawsuit and we go to court. So whether it's survey, whether it's an attorney, spend the money up front to make sure things are done right, because it's so much cheaper on the front end than the back end.
Is there any way, I want to back up on something, because I was misinformed, and I mean, I'm in real estate for a profession. So we talked about that there's no such thing as, let me back up. So you can be landlocked in Texas. And I was always under the impression, and I hear it from Bob and Joe and Farmer Tom, you can't landlock me, but you know, I can do what I want. And so we always talk about this, even in contract law, like about a dominant in the Serbian estate or the subordinate estate, mm-hmm. or whatever. So the dominant estate is going to be the one that needs the easement. And I'm sort of blown away that you can be landlocked. Like, I really thought you had to let somebody find some way to get in there. And that blows my mind.
Not in Texas. And like I said, it's a myth that's out there a lot. I call it coffee shop law, right? That's where Joe and Tom are doing their legal practice, is that coffee shop. But yeah, in Texas, no. Now, like I say, there's like five different ways in the law you can potentially get access. Things like an easement by necessity, easement by prescription, easement by estoppel. There's some options. But again, those are all real fact specific. I mean, I can give you an example of a case where none of those would work, because they just couldn't prove the specific facts you had to prove to get them. And in that scenario, that woman had no option. Like, she was absolutely landlocked. Nobody had to give her access. And the value of that property went way down, right? Because she had two potential buyers, the guys on either side of her, right? Because nobody else is going to buy that property. It's just not marketable. And so this lady had to sell it at a real discount to one of the neighbors that wouldn't give her an easement.
Yeah, that makes sense. I've got one that I tried for a year to get the neighbor to buy, and he wouldn't do it because he didn't need to, because he surrounded her. I don't know how this place ended up in his ranch. He was like, I don't need it. He's like, I graze it now anyway. There's no fence. Yeah. I was like, oh, that could bring up open range, but he wouldn't buy it, not even at a discounted rate. I felt so bad for that lady. She inherited it, thought she was going to get this windfall, and it was worthless. Yep. But in the back of my...
it's important to look through those options, right? Those potential options for how you could prove an implied easement. But just know, like, if you can't meet the requirements of one of those, you're out of luck.
God, that is wild. So she could have built a helicopter pad, I guess, and flown in there. But other than that, that would have been right.
Yep.
That's mind-bending. Of course, you know, talking about some of this stuff with fences being off and easements fenced out and things of that nature. Usually I just call the neighbors first and be like, you got any desire to buy this? Cause our fences are all messed up. And so far, a lot of them seem to be willing to, I've got one right now. Well, let me back up. So let's just pose an example. So we get a survey done and you find out that there is a water well drilled registered to, say, a neighbor. And they're selling water for oil production to the neighbor. If you look at the tax records, the way those parcel boundaries were laid out, that it should have been on their place, but it's not because we had it surveyed. Yeah, that's how would you go about that? Because they drilled it on your place.
Yeah. That was a mess, right? Because now you've got this issue, not only of the fences are off or whatever, but now you've got a water well on another person's property. That's going to take a lot more than we probably have time to get into on a podcast, yeah. Right? But that's where you got to get those parties sit down and see if they can't sort out something that they're going to do. Maybe one of them pays the other one for it. Maybe they change the boundary. I mean, there's lots of different options there, but that's something you sure need to get sorted out because, again, you could end up in a real mess of a lawsuit over that being in the wrong spot.
Yeah, we're looking at a really good cash contract price, maybe, but we'll see. I don't know. It's interesting. But so, like, what about the one where I was telling you where we have the easement and it is recorded? I could see it in the contract. Like, I knew it was there. I found some documents in the tax records. Luckily, you know, I don't know what it's like in other states, like where Mac's at in Idaho. I can get on Texas File and find a lot of stuff depending on the county. Not every county has all their stuff scanned in electronically. But, you know, once we got it surveyed, we did identify the actual easement, but it's fenced out and there's no road there. So who knows how long it's been since that was in use. You can see the old wire gaps where it used to be two generations ago, probably. I mean, this is out in the sand dunes, like of the Western Panhandle. So, I mean, there's an entire fence on this place that's literally buried by sand. So that road's gone, but you can still see the old gap on the county road and they've just wired it shut. I mean, I guess knowing what we know now, we see it, it's recorded. I have a survey to prove it. I mean, if we say this was a buyer and he buys this property and I actually probably do have the buyer on this. Can he just like, did we just track down the neighbor and say, hey, look, I've got this easement right here and I'd really like to open that back up. Can you unwire the gate? I mean, unless they, you know, they should say yes. Okay, that's cool. But what if they say, nah, I'm not doing that? I mean, what do you got to do then?
Yeah. I mean, you could end up having to go to court. And I think you're approaching it the exact right way. I would go to the neighbor, right? And I would have a copy of, here's a survey. Here's the easement. Look at the language of the easement. It probably says something like free and unlimited access or something that, right, where they can't like fence off your access. The fact that there's not a road there now doesn't do away with the easement that they were granted, right? So, I mean, they should be able to still use it. But yeah, I think you go and approach the neighbor with all your information. Well, at least what should happen there is the neighbor would take that to a lawyer, right? Have a lawyer look over it, see if any of it's accurate, and hopefully y'all could work out a deal. I mean, if not, then you could potentially file a lawsuit against the neighbor. Again, that would be like last resort kind of stuff. But you could potentially file a lawsuit against the neighbor for trespass. Maybe a breach of contract, there's different types of claims. You could seek a declaratory judgment, having them declare that that's your easement. They have to remove the fence. So you could end up in court on it. Now, again, if you could work it out with the neighbor, that's always a better option.
Yeah, I'm sure they probably wouldn't do a court thing. I wouldn't think. They probably don't know it exists, if I had to guess.
Probably not.
That thing's ancient. That contract that I have is from the 60s. But yeah. And it's real descriptive, though. So, and we talked about this earlier, about having an attorney that drafts the easement. This thing not only talks about where it starts in the northeast corner of section so-and-so and the northwest corner of section so-and-so on the property line, and it's 30 feet wide and it's 1320 feet long. I mean, it's like super duper descriptive. I mean, and so there's zero doubt once you read it, you knew like it should be there. But once we surveyed it, we were able to verify.
Yeah, find it. Well, and you're lucky there because a lot of those old easements, whether they're for a road or whether they're for a pipeline or whatever, are terrible. They're like super blanket easements that have none of that level of detail. And folks can run into a lot of trouble with those now because they're just so broadly written that they allow almost anything.
Yeah. So, and we were talking about fences. So let's kind of, and I know I don't want to, it's up to, I don't know if Mac wants to talk about it. I could go about this stuff all day long because I'm just fascinated. I'm fascinated by it because it's very technically difficult and it's very, 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 very important. And you can get in a lot of hot water over all of this. And we live in this world, right? Every day in real estate, it's scary. So let's just say there are no fences. We talked about this before we hopped on the actual recorded part here. So there's no fence. And the neighbor's got cattle on there. You buy it. They don't care. They just got their cows out, right? And you go over there and say, I want you to get your cows off. And they say, well, I don't have to. This is open range out here. If you want them off, build a fence. So is that the correct, is that true? I guess is where I'm going with that.
Yeah. So again, Texas law, right? With our big disclaimer, this is just in Texas. Lawyer answer is it depends on where you're located. In Texas, the general rule, kind of our starting point, is that the state of Texas is open range. Open range means fence out, which in your example would mean if you don't want the neighbor's cows on you, it's your job to fence them out, right? You're the one who has to build the fence to keep the cows out. However, okay, so we assume to start with Texas is open range. However, a lot of counties have passed what are called local stock laws. And those local stock laws change either all or part of the county from open range to closed range. And in a closed range scenario, that means it's the obligation of the livestock owner to fence his animals in. And so it really depends on where you are in the state as to the answer to that question. If you're in an open range area, then the obligation is on the new landowner to fence the neighbor's cows out. If you're in a closed range area, the obligation is on the cattle owner to fence his cattle in. So critical to know if the specific place you're standing has a local stock law or not, because that's going to dictate the answer to your question.
Okay. So I had read that it could be changed by the county, but I didn't know if that was true or not. So it is.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's done by voters. Counties can have elections and the landowners get to vote on whether they want to change it from open range to closed range. Where this gets tricky is a lot of those elections were held in like the early 1900s. And the results are in the commissioner court records in like cursive handwriting. And you have to go like searching to find them. But yeah, that's how the law works, that the voters can vote to change to closed range.
Oh, that's really cool. The open range concept in itself, I'd never heard of until I joined National Land and started working in the range field. Cause I was a range specialist with Natural Resource Conservation Service. But I mean, you know, we're just operating on people's property and they're not going to go root plow the neighbor or, right, you know, do whatever. So none of that really mattered to me. I was just doing conservation work. But you get into the land sale side and then you start getting into this legal end of it all. And it's like, okay, this is a whole nother ballgame.
And this too is something that comes up a lot. There was a kind of a rich person who owned land out in far west Texas within the last couple of years. And they got real frustrated with their neighbor's cows coming on their property. It was an open range county and they kept calling the sheriff being like, come pick these cows up. They don't belong here. And they ended up in a real like kerfuffle in the county. And they asked the attorney general for an opinion about whether because we have what's called an estray law here, which says basically if there's animals on your property that don't belong to you, you can call the sheriff and have them removed. That's another lesson. You can't take them to the sale barn and send your neighbor the check. I get that question sometimes. No, that's not legal. You have to call the sheriff. But the question came up, can you call the sheriff if it's an open range county, right? So out there, it was open range. The obligation was on the neighbor to build a fence, but she just kept calling the sheriff saying, these cattle are on my property. These cattle are on my property. And Texas courts have never answered the question of whether she can do that or not. And we still don't have an answer because they didn't go to court over it. But these issues come up, I mean, in real life.
I did not know that estray law. That's interesting. I mean, I've heard of it, and my family's actually had to do that to a neighbor and call the sheriff. But I thought that was just because my granddad was really mad. But I didn't know
granddad was following the law.
He was following because if you inadvertently harm one of the animals, you're liable for it. So you want the sheriff to do it so that the onus is on the sheriff, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, that, and like I say, everybody's like, well, this cow's been here for however long. I'm going to claim squatter's rights. They claim that, Matt. I'm going to claim squatter's rights. Now it's mine. No.
You didn't sit on the cow every day.
Yeah, that's not a thing. So anyway, that's another place. There's a statute. It's in the agriculture code, pretty clear on what has to happen. The short answer is you got to contact the sheriff if they're on your property. They don't belong to you. Now, I always tell people, right, like, if you know whose they are, if his cows just got out, call your neighbor, right? Like, let's be good neighbors first. But if you don't know whose they are, or you've got a neighbor who makes this impossible, then the legal remedy is to call the sheriff.
Somewhere out there is a sheriff listening to this podcast thinking, please, nobody call me to herd cattle.
There have been real issues where the sheriffs are like, the people have been like, the sheriff says they won't come get them. But the law says the sheriff has to come get them. There's a whole deal. Yeah.
Oh, that's fun. Yeah. Well, hey, so I do want to be respectful of your time. We had you blocked for an hour. I want to talk off recording, though, because I would love to have you back. I got a lot out of this. I think this was absolutely fantastic. But I do also want to give you an opportunity because you also host a podcast. Tell anybody listening how they might find your podcast and any information that you have out there.
Yeah, absolutely. So my podcast is called Ag Law in the Field. We're on all the usual podcast channels, or you can Google us. We've got a website. I think we've got about 175 different episodes talking about everything ag law related you could think of. We've definitely done easement episodes. We've got fence law episodes. We do a lot of estate planning, environmental law, things like that. Really fun episode we did. It's called Ag Law Lessons from Yellowstone. So if you watch the TV show Yellowstone, we kind of walk through there and talk about different scenarios and how maybe they would or wouldn't be quite accurate with how the law works. So that one was kind of fun. But yeah, it's called Ag Law in the Field. I've also kind of the landing place for all the content I create is it's called the Texas Agriculture Law Blog. It's not just Texas specific. We cover a lot of different things. All the handbooks I've written are on there. So like I mentioned, there was a handbook that talks about landlocked property. We've got a fence law handbook as well. You can download all those for free on that website. And then the last thing I'll plug for the real estate agents who might be listening is we've got a number of in-person programs we do around the state, and we can offer CE credit to real estate agents. So if this was interesting to you and you want CE credit, I can help. You can look at my website. I've got a list of all my upcoming presentations. We'll be in San Angelo in April. We'll be in San Marcos in August. And then we're going to go to East Texas, I think, in September. So if that's something you guys are interested in, feel free to reach out and we'll get you the information.
I will provide a link to that site as well.
Perfect.
In the podcast notes. Make sure that we link to that and give that as a resource. But Tiffany, thank you so much. This was absolutely, I love this. And Wayne, thank you as always.
Yeah, absolutely. I was just thrilled. I reached out to her. It's just a random email. And I was like, she's going to probably be like, who is this guy? I have no idea who this guy is. He says he's a realtor. And she fired off real quick and was like, I'd love to. And I was like, oh, I was like fanboy, like, all right. Cause I've watched a lot of this stuff and I read a lot of her content and it's rock solid. And it's really and like, I wanted to sit down and hear all this. So I really appreciate Tiffany, hopping on and sharing her time and her expertise with us. Cause this is awesome.
Yeah, for sure. It was fun. Anytime. I'd love to do it again. You guys are fun. You got great questions.
Cool. Thank you. This concludes episode number 89 for the National Land Realty Podcast, discussing land laws with Tiffany Lashmet, Associate Professor and Extension Specialist in Agricultural Law at Texas A&M University, and Wayne Dunson, Managing Broker of National Land Realty's Odessa office in West Texas. You can learn more about land ownership and the buying and selling of land at nationalland.com. And just in case you're wondering, getting all of those credentials right without stuttering was extremely difficult. Got it, though. Enjoy and thank you for listening.